Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence. All right, so that's Revelation chapter 20. We're going to start in verse number 7, and we'll finish out the chapter today. All right, let's go ahead. Let's read the first section. Well, let's just read them all the way through. We'll read them all the way through starting in verse number 7 down to verse 15. All right, here we go. Y'all ready?
Yes.
All right. And when the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations that are at the four corners of the earth. Right? Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. Their number is like the sand of the sea. And they marched over the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints in the beloved city. But fire came down from heaven and consumed them. And the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur, where the beast and the false prophet were. And they were tormented day and night forever and ever. Verse 11. Then I saw a great white throne and him who seated on it. From his presence, earth and sky fled away, and no place was found for them. And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and books were opened. Then another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged by what was written in the books, according to what they had done. Verse 13. And the sea gave up the dead who were in it. Death and Hades gave up the dead who were in it. And they were judged, each one of them, according to what they had done. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death. This is the second death, the lake of fire. Verse 15, last one. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. All right, so over the past several weeks that we've been in Revelation, this kind of final chapters, we've noticed that we've gotten one big story that goes all the way from chapter 12 all the way into the first part of chapter 20. And we titled that The Cycle of the Dragon, or The Dragon Cycle. And we had some key players in that cycle, and we spent a lot of time, many weeks, kind of going through that. Today marks a noted change in scene and in segment within the overarching message of Revelation, or the overarching kind of action of Revelation, probably a better way to say it. And we can know that, I got this on your outline, there's two key ideas that help us realize, and there's literary ideas that help us realize that we are now moving into a new segment, right? And so here are the two ideas. So both literary ideas. One of them is the verbs that appear, the major verbs in this first section, chapter 7 through verse 7 through 11, and then new characters. They're not new to us, but the way they're described is new. Anyway, you'll see what I mean. All right, so verbs. For the last several weeks, we've noted how our verbs in Revelation, in this dragon cycle, a lot of them, especially toward the end, were past tense, even though the action had not already occurred. And when we talked about that, we said that John is using the past tense to describe, even though they haven't happened, it's already as good as done, right? But he uses a past tense, right? A past tense verb. That's pretty consistent through this dragon cycle, especially there toward the end of it, right? 17, 18, 19, and into 20, John uses a past tense verb, right? Today, though, look at what he says. Let's go back. It's a verse number 7, right? Let's read it together. Look at it. It's on the screen. You can read it in your Bible, on your phone. Here we go. What does he say? The major verb. And Satan, look at it. What is it? Will be released. Now, English scholars, is that past, present, or future tense? Future tense, right? Okay, that's interesting. All right, here we got it. We got another one. Verse number 8, first couple lines. What does he say? And will come out. So does he say will come out? Past, present, future. You can future. There we go. All right, good job, English college. I'll get a gold star for that. All right. So what does that tell us? For the first time, potentially, I use the word potentially, John is actually referring to noted future events. Right? So he's used past tense verbs to describe a reality. Even though it hasn't happened in the life of the believers that he's writing to, it's as good as done. But now John is definitively talking about the future because he uses future tense verbs. Now you say, whoa, it's a little confusing here. All right. That's not to say, here's what my point is. John is making a literary point. Some of this that we've talked about over the last several weeks, like clearly Christ has not returned, right? Yes, we're still here. Right? Those of us who believe in Jesus and have given our life to him, we're still here, right? So clearly that's a future event. But John's making a literary point that it's as good as already done, even in the life of the believers that he's writing to, and it's as good as done for us as well. What he's writing about today is a noted future event that has not happened yet. So he uses a future tense verb. We'll kind of see how that plays out when we get to the kind of the end and make some assessments of what John's saying. All right, here's the other way we can note that this is kind of a new segment and it's differentiated from what we talked about in chapters 12 through the first part of 20 in this dragon cycle, is you don't see any mention of some of the key figures from that cycle. For example, the dragon, not around anymore. Now, the beasts are mentioned, but it's only in passing to note where Satan ends up. So who's the figure that's the main driver in these verses? Who's the main actor? Well, there's God and there's Satan. And John uses the differentiating names, especially for Satan, to note that this is a definitive mark between what we talked about previously and what we're going to talk about now. So in the dragon cycle of chapter 12 through 20, verse 6, Satan's name is the dragon, repeatedly, right? That character fades away. It's a new character today, right? In literary terms, not in real terms, but in literary terms, right? And John is doing these are literary markers to let the readers know that this is a new scene. It's kind of like when you're reading a book or you're watching, you're reading a fairy tale and it's like once upon a time, right? If you're reading a book and you hear the phrase once upon a time, what do you immediately know? Okay, this isn't real. You want to know why? Because when we were all kids, that's the way every Disney movie started, right? So that's a literary marker that if a modern day John was writing a modern version of Revelation, I'll give you a few more modernizations that somebody today could make to help us connect some dots. That's like a phrase that he would use. That's exactly what John's doing, something like that today with a change in verb and a change in character. I say all of that to say that John is this time definitively pushing this event that we're going to talk about today into the future. Okay? We all clear as mud? Maybe slightly stained water. All right, here we go. All right, so there are some key ideas. Well, that is maybe a little foggy. There are some key ideas that John hits on that we need to discuss right now. Here's the first one. Satan deceives. Whenever and whatever John is going to describe, it is resolutely clear what Satan is going to do. Satan, he says, is going to deceive. It's on verse 8. He will come out and do what? Deceive the nations. That word deceive there means to cause to wander or to mislead. Right? Cause to wander or to mislead. Has anybody, has anybody seen the newest episodes of The Rings of Power? Have you? Lee, thank you. The only one. Listen to me. You may not be a Lord of the Rings fan. That is quite all right. Okay? I'm going to make another Lord of the Rings reference later. Just hang with me. All right? You don't have to know the storyline or anything. But you need to watch this season's... I haven't gotten through all of them. I'm about episode 5. But from episode 1 to episode 5, if you want to know what it looks like for Satan to deceive the nations, you need to get Amazon Prime and you need to watch The Rings of Power Season 2, episodes 1 through 5. Because the archetype of evil in the Lord of the Rings
universe, Sauron, does a masterful job of deceiving everybody and manipulating everybody into doing exactly what he wants them to do while making them think it's their own idea. I sat there Friday as I was putting sealer on some wood projects, watching this going, oh my gosh, they did a fabulous job of explaining what it means to deceive the nations. It is phenomenal, at least episode 5. I don't know what's going to happen next, but listen, the dude, he makes everybody do exactly what he wants them to do it, even when they don't want to do it. He manipulates them to do it anyway. Masterful. And that's exactly what this means when it says Satan goes around to deceive the nations. Misleading them, misinforming them, making him do whatever he wants them to do to bring about the end goal that he has desire to do. And what is it? Well, the desire is to bring about one last final battle in what would be termed, if you watch Westerns, a showdown, right? There's a big showdown with the Lord coming up. And that's his goal, is to deceive the nations into thinking that they can defeat the Lord's people and the Lord in this one final big battle royale kind of thing. All right? And so that's Satan, and that's his role. He deceives the nations into doing what he wants them to do. Now, there's these other characters, and they show up in verse number 8 as well. And it's Gog and Magog. Gog and Magog. Now, this is the only time that these two names appear in the New Testament. But they are a reference back to Ezekiel chapter 38. They appear there. But listen to me. When they appear in Ezekiel, it is not Gog and Magog, but rather it is Gog of Magog. In other words, Ezekiel presents Gog as a prince of a land called Magog. Is that clear? Gog of Magog, a prince of the land of Magog. John takes that and kind of morphs it and says Gog and Magog to represent that it's more than one person or one, it's a multinational deal, right? Now, the big question is who, right? Who is John referring to? Who is John describing when he says Gog and Magog or Gog and Magog, right? Who's he trying to describe? Well, prophets of the apocalypse, I use that in air quotes, big, giant air quotes, prophets of the apocalypse in the late 80s would have said it was Russia, right? The communist evil, the Red Army, ooh, the boogeyman, right? But after Ronald Reagan said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, and the wall, the Berlin Wall fell down and all that, then the prophets of the apocalypse said, who? Early 90s? Who? No. We're not there yet. Not there yet. Y'all jumping ahead over here in the right corner. Who was the prophets of the apocalypse? Come on. Some of you, or at least somebody went to Saddam Hussein. Remember? Desert Storm. Right? And then once we defeated him the first time, early 2000s, prophets of the apocalypse. Who's Gog and Magog? Come on. Nope, not y'all jumping ahead. Not China yet. Come on, we're not there yet. Come on. We spent 20 years there, and then we pulled out and left a lot of stuff there. Afghanistan. Thank you. Osama bin Laden. Al-Qaeda. Afghanistan, right? Armies of the North. Come on, guys. Y'all have not read Ezekiel yet. Let's go. All right. But 20 years later, Osama bin Laden's dead. Who knows what's going on in Afghanistan anymore? This is your moment. Who's Gog and Magog? Thank you, China. Wait a minute now. In the last year, there's been a couple other people added to this. Who are they? Iran, that's good. And who else? They're in a massive war now. Not Israel. Not Ukraine, the other country. Russia, there we go. Come on, guys. There are enemies. Right? They are our enemies. And then throw in a side of North Korea as well, just for good measure. So here's my question. The prophets of the apocalypse have labeled all of these people as Gog and Magog. And what's the one thing that all of them have in common? What do they all have in common? They have one major thing in common. They are our enemies. Right? You ever thought about that? I said, that's weird. Like that only enemies of the United States make it on the Gog and Magog list? Like, why isn't Argentina on the list? Or Tanzania? Or Tanzania, however you pronounce it. Why don't they ever make it on the prophets of the apocalypse list? What about Indonesia and Laos? Why aren't they on the list? Oh, that's right, because they're not our enemies, right? Prophets of the apocalypse would have you and I believe that only the enemies of the United States and the United States' friends are Gog and Magog. But here's the reality. If we go back and we read Ezekiel 38, even Ezekiel 38, listen to me, Gog of Magog, the prince Gog of the land of Magog, is an absolute abstraction of evil. And it's the sum totality of all that is evil in the world that is against God's people. So listen to me. If Ezekiel uses the image of Gog and Magog as an abstract image to represent all that is evil in the world, and John picks that image up, what do we think John means by it? A definitive place and land? No. He means it is an abstraction of all that is evil in the world. Here's why. Logically, you and I can't find Gog and Magog on a map. It would be like putting a map up and us throwing darts at it. We'd have just as good of a chance. Like, we don't know, because it's meant to be an abstract idea that collects all that is evil in the world. So, it would be like, here's your second Lord of the Rings reference. Listen to me. If you haven't watched Lord of the Rings, you just need to devote an entire day and 9 hours and just watch the whole trilogy, and it'll make sense. And then you can go back and watch the Hall of the Hobbit movies, and then you can watch the Rings of Power. It's worth it, I promise. Just take a week, you know, and just watch it all. All right, here's... If John were writing the apocalypse today, instead of Gog and Magog, you know what reference he would use? Sauron of Mordor. And if you know Lord of the Rings, you realize Sauron, or even if you don't, J.R.R. Tolkien wrote that as a fictional series. And the character Sauron of Mordor is the abstract idea that's put in a cinematic form that represents all that is evil in the world. He's the Antichrist figure. He's the evil figure in the whole Lord of the Rings series. And so if John were writing the apocalypse today, he would use that instead of Gog and Magog. So why does he use Gog and Magog? Because that is in his realm of knowledge, and he knows that that's what Ezekiel meant by it way back when. And he's a good Hebrew person who's read his Old Testament, and so he wrote, Gog and Magog, right? So it fits. Both of them are abstractions of all that is evil in the world. They're characters that they form to represent the totality of evil brought into just given a name. So listen to me. If you hear someone out there on the internet talk about how Gog and Magog is Red China and the Russians and North Korea, you just need to... Well, you can keep listening and go, right? Nobody knows. Nobody. Nobody. Because that's not what the image is meant to bring about. So what does it mean then? So if it is an abstraction of all that is evil in the world, what is the abstraction then? What does it mean? How is John using that abstract term in reality? He's saying that all people from all places that are against God's people are brought to bear in this scene, this final battle scene. That Satan has gone out to deceive the nations to such a way that all the people that are not with God are against God's people, right? I mean, he does. There's numerous as the number of sands on the sea, right? So what happens?
Well, the interesting part is that we have all of this battle image, but when we get to verse number 9, let's look at that again. When we get to verse number 9, we see that there's not really a battle, right?
I mean, let's read it. It looks like we're you know, in a Tombstone, like, you know, Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday are all walking down for a showdown. You think it's going to be a big shootout in verse number 9, but what happens? And they marched. That is, this large, evil army marched over the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints in the beloved city. And there was a great battle, and God barely won, right? That's what it says? No, what does it say? But fire came down from heaven and consumed them. Dun, dun, dun. Right? I mean, it's somewhat anticlimactic, right? You've got this entire buildup of this entire book, and it's like, and fire came down and consumed them. And you're like, but wait, I need more. Like, I need details here. But there's not any. Which has been consistent for John for every quote-unquote battle scene in the entire book. What does that tell us again? There's no battle between God and his enemies. Right? Fire consumes them. Right? Now here's the different part. The different part is what occurs in verses 10 and 11. Right? What happens in verse 10? After the fire comes down, what happens in verse 10? Let's look at it. And the devil, Satan, the devil, who had deceived them, was what? Thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur, where the beast and false prophet were, and they were tormented, will be tormented day and night for ever and ever. In other words, right? Previously, in these big battle scenes, it was Rome and its proxies kind of being talked about. And now we have Satan being talked about. And so God is dealing not with the proxies, but with the person behind them. Right? He's not dealing with Satan's minions. He's dealing with the person who's doing the deceiving. And so this time we see that there's no out for Satan after this event. However this looks, whatever it looks like, God takes Satan and he throws him into the lake of fire. There's two application points I want to bring out in just a minute. But what we see here is a definitive end to evil, right? This image of the lake of fire, of sulfur, that's John's image of hell, right? Similar to how Jesus describes hell in the Gospels. And see, it is forever and ever without end. All right. So now, let me talk real quickly before we move on. Real quickly. All right. What is some information not given in this passage? There's three things that we want to know that we assume is in this passage, but it's not. And John doesn't tell us. Here they are. Number one, John does not give us the location of the battle. Does he? What does he say? Broad plain, beloved city. Which one? Which broad plain? Are we talking about the Great Plains of the United States? That would fit the bill, right? Broad plain. Are we talking about, hey, wait a minute now. Aren't we talking about the broad plains of Ukraine that feed the world? Who knows? There are broad plains all over the world that would fit the bill. Beloved city. What city? Do you love your city? I love it. There's a lot of beloved cities. Prophets of the apocalypse would say, oh, it's got to be Jerusalem, but does it? Does he say Jerusalem here? Wait a minute. No. What does he say? Beloved city. In other words, again, anyone who tries to nail down a hard location doesn't know what they're talking about because John doesn't tell us. Here's the other thing. Who is the definitive identity of the army? John doesn't tell us. He doesn't tell us. He just says it's evil in nature and it's all those who are against God. And John doesn't tell us when the battle takes place, does he? He gives us no definitive markers other than when the 1,000 years are up. But last week we saw that the 1,000 years need to be understood symbolically just because all the other numbers in Revelation are understood that way. So you say, well, Pastor, when's this going to take place? Here again, I'm going to quote one of my professors who wrote a great book that I've been using on Revelation. His name is Gerald Stevens. Here's how he said it.
The crisis will be so huge that the church won't have to guess. Sounds good to me. All right, let's move on. Verse number 11 through 15. Now that Satan has been dealt with, what happens to all those who followed after him? And what happens to all the believers now that Satan has been finally dealt with? Well, John's going to take the rest of the book to answer those two questions. What happens to those who follow the beast, the false prophet, the false propagandist, Satan, the enemy, who are enemies of God's, earth dwellers? Like, what happens to them? And then John's going to answer what happens to those who follow after God and follow the Lamb and serve Him and all that, right? So in verse 11 through 15, he's going to highlight what happens to the enemies of God. So John sees a great white throne kind of coming down, and in his presence, and as the throne comes down, there's somebody seated on the throne, and it says that earth and sky fled away, and there was no place for them to be found. Well, this is John. John is describing another scene where God is the central figure, where God the Father is the central figure. And so earth and sky flee away. And then after that, what does John see? He sees all the dead. What does it say? Great and small. Everybody. From everywhere. From the sea. From Hades. Everybody is brought before this. Nobody. John's point. Nobody escapes. Everybody is there. And what does he tell us? He says they open some books, and he specifically mentions one by name. He calls it the Book of Life. Now, we've met the Book of Life prior in Revelation, and when we did, here's how we described it, and the same bears true here. It is the citizen's roll of heaven. In other words, to have access into heaven. Now, we don't know what heaven's going to be like yet, because we hadn't read about it in Revelation. John hadn't gotten to that point. But what John says is, if you're going to make it into God's heaven, your name has to be in the book. There's no way you gain access into heaven if your name is not in the book of life of the Lamb. Right? And so John says that as his throne descends, the dead are gathered and books are open. And he says that the dead were judged by what was written in the books. And he adds this little phrase. And if we're not careful, we'll misinterpret this phrase. It's the last phrase in verse 12. It says, according to what they had done. Now, if we took that phrase out of context, we would say, entrance into heaven is about works that you can do. Right? That's what it says. According to what they had done. However, when we put it back in the context in which John wrote it, and in understanding what that book of life means, and in the broader context of the entire book of Revelation, the phrase we could interpret, which we need to interpret it, is this: according to what they had done equals what have you done with Jesus? In other words, the way you have entrance into heaven and the way in which your name is added into the book of life, or the way it is preserved in the book of life, is answering the question that Jesus asked his disciples: who do you say that I am? Right? That's what gets you into heaven, if you answer that question correctly. And there's only one answer. It's not you're a good guy, you're the big guy upstairs, not a prophet, a good teacher. He said, it is you are the Savior, the Christ, the Lord, the one who died for my sins, and I'm placing all of my faith and trust in you. That's the only answer, or some version of that, right? Anything else, not good enough. So the dead are judged based off what they have done with Jesus. Have they made him the Lord of their life? Have they given their life to him? Have they trusted in him fully? Verse 13 goes on and says that, let's go to verse 14. Sorry. It says, then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire, the second death, and it ends with 15. Anyone's name
who was not found written in the book of life, he, she, was thrown into the lake of fire. In other words, the end, or what theologians call the final state for the unbelievers, John refers to as being thrown into the lake of fire, which in the previous verse, Ren, go back to verse 14, he calls the second death. Now, this is interesting. It's interesting that John would phrase eternity for Satan and his minions and those who don't believe in Jesus, listen to me, as the second death. All right, now, follow with me. John is not saying that people who live without the Lord are going to be resurrected or brought to bear in this final scene to only die again. Okay? That's not... Let me walk it out, okay? Somebody lives their life, they don't love the Lord. They don't believe in Jesus, they never give their heart and life to Him. They die, and then at this scene, they're brought back to life, because remember, everybody's there. John is not saying they died once and then they die again. Does that make sense? That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is that their final state of living is so bad that it's like dying. He's describing, what he's doing is he's telling us the awful reality of hell. It's not that when people go to hell, they die again. But it's that the life that they're living while they're there is so bad that the only word to describe how bad it is death. But yet they're living. Lake of fire, burning with sulfur. Jesus describes it as where the fire doesn't end and the worm never dies. He describes it as a garbage heap, a dumpster fire. A maggot-infested dumpster fire. That's how Jesus describes it. And so John says, that type of living is not really living. It's like death. But they experience that. The people who end up there experience that forever and ever and ever without end. That's a bad reality. I mean, that's awful. Right? Here's the reality. There are people in our circles, that's where they're headed. Right? That's where they're headed, unfortunately. All right, so what is the point for us today? What are some things that we can gather about this passage and how it can apply? What are some ideas we can grasp on? I've got several. All right, so here's the first one, okay? Here's the first one. And it's a point when we were talking about Gog and Magog. All right, here's the reality. Here's what we see in this kind of dragon cycle into what we talked about today, which is kind of the end of the end, right? The end in judgment. Is that, listen to me. We can deal with all the proxies of evil we want to. But that doesn't mean evil's going to end until the one who is behind all the evil is dealt with. You understand what I mean? Hey, look, in our community, we can do all the good programs and all of the good things, and we can try to eradicate drugs and alcohol and violence, and we should, and we can try to rid our school systems of all of those things. But you know what? Here's the reality. Those things are still going to happen. You want to know why? Because Satan is in the world deceiving people to do what he wants them to do. And until he's dealt with, not only will you have those problems, but listen to me. Here's kind of the more pointed thing for us as the church. Listen to me. We, as Christians, will be under attack. It may not be locally here, but globally, until Satan is dealt with, we can expect Christ followers to be under attack in some way, shape, or form. It doesn't matter who the president is. It doesn't matter what laws get passed. As long as Satan is floating around, however he moves, there will be attacks on people who believe what we believe. That's just the reality. However, there is hope for us today, because one day God will definitively deal with evil and put it away. That whole phrase of death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire, it means that God is not only dealing with the perpetrator of the evil, but he's dealing with the symptoms and the effects of the evil as well. And we'll see that more clearly when we get into next week's, into chapter 21 and 22. Because we'll see that when we look at heaven, there is no evil anymore. There is no bad, because God has dealt with it in a finalistic way. Right? Here's another thing I think we can learn. And this would go against popular culture. Popular culture would have you to believe that the devil, Satan, is the Lord of hell, and that he's going to run the place, and it's going to be a big party. Right? Right? Absolutely. But that is a Greek, Roman, mythological idea, not a Christian idea. Greek and Roman mythology would have you believe that Hades and Pluto are down there ruling the underworld. But what does the Bible tell us? Satan is not Lord of hell. He is a captive in hell. And it's not a party. And it's not a lot going on other than suffering. And so what does that tell us? God is sovereign, not over just this world and not over heaven, but he's also sovereign over hell as well. So the God that is on the throne, the God that's with us on the mountain, and in the valley, he's sovereign over eternity as well. Both the awesome side of it and both the awful side of it. Right?
All right, so let's move on. Real quick. here's kind of the rubber meets the road for you and I today. And it's kind of a dual idea. Works don't get us into heaven. And those who don't believe in Jesus have a very different final residency than those who do.
Right? So here's where the rubber meets the road for you and I, and for me too. Hey, listen. There are people in our circles who don't believe in Jesus. They don't. Now, we can't make them believe, and we sure can't force it down their throats. But the question we've got to ask ourselves is, have we done everything we could to be a witness and example to them, to bring them in to the kingdom of God? And that's something that each and every one of us has to ask ourselves.
Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.